Not exactly. Yeah, let me get. Well, he ran away. Yeah, that's true. And then after a very successful career in Ethiopia, Moshe Rabbeinu decided to settle down. So he went to Midian. And in Arabia, Moshe Rabbeinu ends up marrying Tzipora. And then he goes into his father-in-law's employment. And that brings us to the fourth reading of Parsha Shemot. In the end of the third reading, we hear of the fourth and final slave phase of slavery and of torture. And it gets really, really bad. And the Jewish people just can't take it anymore. And they cry out to God, and God hears. And at this point, we get reintroduced to Moshe Rabbeinu. So God examines the behavior of Moshe, of Moses, who was tending his father-in-law's sheep. His father-in-law was called Yeter. Later he gets known as Yitro, but we call him Yitro now. He is the deposed ruler of Midian, or at least the chief spiritual authority. And God examines Moshe's behavior and concludes that he is suitable as a redeemer. That's the way we need to understand the beginning of chapter 3, which is also the opening of the third of the fourth reading. Moshe hayaroya eszein Yisrei. Moshe was tending to the flocks of his father-in-law Yisro, Yisro Chesne, who was Kohen Midian, the ruler or highest authority of Midian formerly. Vayinhag es hatzein, and Moshe Rabbeinu leads the sheep achar hamidbar. He leads the sheep beyond the desert or after the desert. And in his journeys with the sheep, he comes to the mountain of God, Choreva, the place that is also known as Chorev. So Rashi tells us, Achar Hamidbar. That's a rather strange way of describing where Moshe Rabbeinu went. Why did he go after the desert? Says Rashi, Lihisrachek min hagozel, because Moshe Rabbeinu lived with the highest of moralities and ethos, and he didn't want to be the cause of something which was illegal, meaning that the sheep would graze in somebody else's property. So he took them achar hamidbar, a place that was far away from where other people's property was situated, shelo yiru b'sdeis acherim, so that they would not graze on other people's property. Now, God examined Moshe Rabbeinu and he saw a shepherd. So what was so impressive with that? And why does that lead God to the conclusion that Moshe Rabbeinu is suitable as the Redeemer? So there's a medrash that says that a kid once ran away from the flock and he reached a shady place that was near the water. And it stopped to drink and Moshe Rabbeinu ran after it. And when he caught up with it, instead of being frustrated and upset that he had to chase after a single solitary sheep, he said, I didn't know that you ran away because you were thirsty, because the kid was drinking. So he said, you must be tired. And Moshe Rabbeinu carried the kid back to the flock. And at that point, God said, because you showed such mercy to a mortal person's flock, you will tend my flock, which is the nation of Israel. All right. So now we understand how being a shepherd actually was what prepared Moshe Rabbeinu for his leadership position. And the interesting thing is, despite the fact that he has enormous political experience, enormous, he grows up in the palace. So he saw firsthand kings and queens and all kinds of people that were coming to the palace. And despite the fact that he runs away, he's got to put his pants on by himself, so to speak. He doesn't have a silver spoon in his mouth anymore. And he has to run away far because running for his life. And there he joins the armed forces. He rises up through the ranks, becomes the general, the commanding, chief commanding officer, and eventually becomes the king of the entire country. And he does that for decades. And the Torah does not tell us about that. That's not what prepared Moshe for his job, because the job of a Rebbe is not a king, he's not a politician, he's not a prime minister. He's ultimately the person who has to have the concern, the care and concern for each and every individual. And when Moshe Rabbeinu could care and have sensitivity, be concerned about every single sheep in the flock, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, this is my leader. Now he comes to Har Ha'Elikim, he comes to the mountain of God, and that's rather strange because maybe it was called Chorev at this point, but how would it be called Har Ha'Elikim? There's no Jewish people yet to speak of. They have not come to Mount Sinai, and God has not yet given them the Torah. So Rashi simply says, Al-Shem Ha'asid. It's called Har Ha'Elikim, but that's because in the future it will be Har Ha'Elikim. And sometimes that's how the Torah speaks to us. Sometimes the Torah will use the names to describe geography or a particular event due to events of the future. It's interesting to point out that it's not only the notion of just events of the future, which we have plenty of that in the Chumash Bereishis, especially with the stories of Avraham Avinu when we identify places. But there's another element here, and that is, as the Ibn Ezra says, that when Moshe Rabbeinu was writing the Torah, it was after the Torah was given. So he's identifying not what was said then, he's going to say what was said then, but he's identifying the mountain, which is Har Ha'Elikim, which is what the mountain is called now. And that's when he was writing the Torah. At any rate, Rashi is not fully comfortable with that. Rashi wants to use the notion that it's Al-Shem Ha'Asid, and that's the way the Torah speaks to us. There are other reasons why Moshe Rabbeinu might have gone far away from the settled area. For example, Rabbeinu Bechaye maintains that Moshe Rabbeinu was seeking prophecy. He was seeking closeness to God. And because he was seeking closeness to God, he wanted to avoid any kinds of inappropriate behavior, and being in civilization, he felt would lead him in an inappropriate direction. And he wanted to be able to be ready for Nevuah. And for Nevuah, he felt he would be best suited if he'd be in a situation of hitbodedut. So after decades of being involved in politics and leadership, he said, let me be with the sheep. The sheep don't talk back. The sheep don't bother me. There's no politics. I know exactly what I have to do. I keep myself busy, and the sheep will enable me to reach and actualize my spiritual potential. In fact, the Abarbanel says that was the sole purpose. It was all about hitbodedut. It was all about this solitary kind of contemplative reality Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to be in. And interestingly, this is how the Shvatim started. This is how Avraham and Yitzchak and Yaakov, this is the things they did. They were all shepherds. So Moshe Rabbeinu, after doing lots of Yosef-like work, reverts back to the good old behavior of the patriarchs and the Shvatim. And at that point, at that moment, suddenly, Vayera Malach Hashem Elov, the angel of God, suddenly appears to him. And he appears to him, the Labas Eish. Labas Eish could be translated in the heart of a blazing fire. And the heart of this blazing fire is situated in the midst of a very dry thorn bush. Moshe Rabbeinu looks, Vayar, and he sees, Vehine hasne boyer, he could see that the bush is on fire. Be'esh vahasne einene ukol, but although the bush is on fire, the bush is not being consumed. What exactly did Moshe Rabbeinu see? So Rashi says, Labas Eish. What is a Labas Eish? Never heard of a Labas Eish. Heard of fire, heard of flames, but what is a Labas? So Rashi says that Labas means Shalheves. It means flames. It means a flame that was blazing. So what does Labas mean though? And Rashi says that because Shalheves, because the blaze of the fire is called Liboy, the heart or the strength, Shel Eish, of the fire. Ukamai, where do we find that there's a heart where there's no heart? So he says, when Moshe Rabbeinu speaks euphemistically about the heavens, he says, Lev Hashamayim, the heart of the heavens. And we also see that in Matan Torah, when there's going to be a fire in exactly the same place, he speaks about the fire that was burning until the heart of the heavens. So the heart, it means then the middle. It doesn't mean necessarily a heart. And in fact, Ibn Ezra goes further and he says, the heart is situated right in the middle of the person's torso. It's not right in the middle, but kind of in the middle. So he says, that's the meaning of the heart of it. Although Rashi seems to emphasize the heart of something as its force, as its strength. Another example we find in the book of Shmuel, it says, Belev Ha'ela. And this is when Avshalom was killed. He had long hair. He was a Nazirite. and his long locks got caught in the thicket of the tree. And it's called in the thicket of the Elah. In the middle of the Elah is called the thicket of it is described as a lave. And Rashi says, okay, then I have a problem. If labas eish means belev ha'esh, why does it say labas? Then it should say belev ha'esh. After all, it said lev ha'shamayim, it said lev ha'elah, it said the heart of the heavens, it said the heart of the tree. So if it's the heart of the heavens, the heart of the tree, and it should be the heart of the fire. Belev ha'esh. What's labas? Says Rashi, v'al tisma latof. Don't be dismayed or surprised at the fact that a tof shows up at the end of the word lev, making it labas. We have similar things to this. With regard to the heart, especially when the heart is spoken in feminine tense, for example, we have the book of Ezekiel, and there in the 16th chapter it says, Ma amula libasech. So he says, the prophet says, how corrupt is your heart? And over there, he uses the terminology of heart in a feminine tense rather than masculine tense. And so the tough is inserted. So if we have the word esh, it seems, is a feminine word, which is modified by feminine, a feminine verb. And since if you want to make, in Hebrew, just like in French, you have a masculine tense and a feminine tense, if you want to feminize the word lev, which is masculine, you add a tough and it becomes a feminine word. So therefore, since it's esh, and esh has a feminine ring to it, so that's why it says labas esh. All right. At any rate, this is the place where God decides to reveal himself, b'tei chasneh. Why b'tei chasneh? So Rashi says, why in the lowly thorn bush? The loy, loy b'ilanachar, Rashi says, not in another tree. And why did God choose this tree specifically? Mishum, because imay anochi b'tzara. God wants to demonstrate to Moshe that he feels the pain of the Jewish people. In other words, he chooses a thorn bush, which is like a, if you will, not really a comfortable bush. But the point of this non-comfortable bush is that it represents Hashem saying to Moshe, my people are not comfortable, I am not comfortable either.
Why do we put emphasis on the snare and not on the malach itself? Like why, you know, obviously it's unnatural, clearly, but to observe a malach is any less...
It doesn't say that Moshe Rabbeinu saw a malach per se. It says a malach appeared to Moshe. But the malach appeared to Moshe, what did he actually see? Vayera means the malach appeared. But what did Moshe see? Vayar, and he saw Vihine Asne Boyer Beish. So did Moshe see a malach? We don't know that. What did Moshe see? A burning bush. What got Moshe to look?
So why would it count that there's a malach?
It says that this was not a burning bush. This was actually a divine, a supernatural occurrence. But what did Moshe see? He saw a burning bush. But he saw, strangely, he goes a little closer. He wants to see what's going on with this burning bush. And when he sees it's burning, but it's not being consumed, as we're going to see in a moment. V'hini hasneh boyer ba'esh, it's blazing with fire, but v'hasneh in any uko.
So you're saying it was a mirage at the
past? No, it's not a mirage.
It's an actual.
It was a miraculous event, a burning bush that wasn't burning. What I'm saying is, I don't know that Moshe saw a malach. It says vayera. When it says vayera, it doesn't mean that he saw a malach. It means the angel of God appeared to Moshe. Vayera means he appeared. Vayera doesn't mean he saw. Vayar means he saw. What did Moshe see? He saw a thorn bush on fire. Vayemer Moshe. And Moshe says, I guess to himself, he's not talking to anybody, he's got no conversationalist with him. Asurana, I want to turn away from here, says Moshe. Let me turn away from what I'm doing right now. The Ere es Hamara Hagod Lazeh. And I have to go and see this remarkable sight. There's something unbelievable here. It's something's on fire and it's not consuming it. Madua la yiver asneh. Why is the bush not burning? Rashi says, Asurana. What do you mean Asurana? It should be, let me go over there. But Asura means to go away from here. So Rashi says, by the way, Uko means Nechel, comes in the term of being consumed. Kamele Ubadba, Ashalukach Misham, Rashi brings tenses, similar tenses, where the word Avad or Nevad becomes Ubad, and Lokach becomes Lukach. So ukal means ochal, or being consumed. Asura no. So Rashi says, asura mikan. It means Moshe says, I will go away from where I am now. Lehiskarev l'sham. Lehiskarev sham, to come closer there. And God says,
who's Moshe talking to?
He's to himself.
Himself.
It doesn't mean he actually verbalized it. He's wearing a headset, you know. It could be like he said to himself. Like, you know, people think. So people thinking could be like a form of communicating with yourself. The point is, Moshe was thinking. This got him thinking. So Moshe says, I gotta go see this. I gotta see what's going on over here. Vayar Hashem kisar lidais. Now God sees that Moshe has turned. Oh, it's working. Vayikra elav elikim. God calls to him, Mitech asneh, from the midst of the burning bush. From the bush. Vayemer Moshe, Moshe. He says, Moshe twice. And Moshe responds and he says, Hineni, here I am. Why does it say Moshe, Moshe twice? Why does God repeat his name two times? So really, this is not a novelty. We've already heard about this. When God speaks to Avram, how many times does he speak to Avram? He speaks to him also twice. And Rashi tells us that this is Lashon Chiba. This is God speaking to Moshe Rabbeinu in an affectionate way. Rabbeinu Bachaya says that when Moshe Rabbeinu was first called, when God first said Moshe, Moshe became totally overwhelmed. And this would be a circumstance we would not be able to hear what follows. So God says Moshe. And Moshe says, Moshe. He says again, Moshe. Now that he has his attention, now God is ready to speak to Moshe, and Moshe will be able to listen. And the first thing that God says to Moshe is, Al tikrav halayim, don't come too close. Stay right where you are. Shal na'alecha me'al raglecha. I want you to remove your footwear, remove your sandals or your shoes from your feet. Ki hamokem asher ata eimed olav, because the place that you're standing, admas kodeshu, this is sacred soil. So Moshe Rabbeinu really is being told two things, if you think about it. Number one is being told, don't come any closer. That's what the Eruch Hayim says. Don't come closer, because this is not for close quarters. This is intense. And number two, because Moshe went away from where he was to come closer. He said, I'm going to come closer. God says, don't come closer. Stay right where you are. And the second thing he says, take your shoes off, because the ground you're standing on is already sacred soil. You're standing on sacred ground. Don't come any closer. Rashi says, what does it mean, shal? Shal means sleifeitz, you slip out of. Kick your shoes off. Remove your shoes. And we see, for example, the Torah describes a circumstance where somebody would accidentally harm or kill somebody else because the handle of the axe and the actual blade of the axe separated. So it says, v'noshal habarzel, that the blade was removed or came off the handle, and used the word nashal. So therefore, the term is things which are together, like the foot is in the shoe, the handle is in the blade, and then it's removed, it's taken out, it's thrown off. Or ki yishal zeisecha. This is talking about the terrible techacha, the rebuke, the curses that come to the Jewish people, and it means that your olive trees will shed their olives or take off their olives. Admas kodeshu. So Rashi says, who is hamakim? This place is sacred ground. So we understand why Moshe can't come closer, because don't come too close. You gotta keep your distance, respectful distance. But what was up with the business of taking your shoes off? Why did he have to take his shoes off? So there are some who have a custom of actually taking their shoes off when they come to holy place. In some parts of the world, that's what they do when they come to a house of worship. It's not necessarily our custom at all. In fact, the Shulchan Aruch says you have to wear shoes when you daven. Makes for a problem in these shiva houses. Everybody takes their shoes off. It's not so simple, you know, because outside it's snowy and muddy and everybody takes shoes off. It's not a simple thing. You're supposed to wear shoes when you daven. So why did he have to take his shoes off? So Rabbeinu Bachaya says the shoes are a euphemism. Shoes represents the material, the most material, the thickest, most material element of one's attire. Shake off the materialism is what God was really saying to Moshe. Yeah, that's very nice, but it's not what it says. It's a nice idea, can represent that too. But the fact is, God says, take your shoes off. So what's up with taking the shoes off? Why did he have to take his shoes off? And I don't know of another explanation than the one I'm going to give you now. In fact, I've never seen any of the sages explain this. But the Rebbe did talk about it. And he talked about it in the late 60s. But very interestingly, there was a manuscript that was found from the 30s in which the Rebbe wrote for himself a very similar idea. And what we're going to learn now is actually conjunctive, put together from some of the things that the Rebbe wrote in his private notebooks and spoke about later, at least on two occasions, in the 1960s. Page Ayin Tes, Simcha Vav. So we begin here with a little quote from the Medrash Rabbah. The Shmois Rabbah says, Kol Mokim Shashchina Nigles, anywhere where the Divine Presence reveals itself, which obviously precludes shoals, because shoals are not necessarily a place of revelation. Also, B'ni'ilas HaSandal, it's prohibited from wearing shoes. Where do we see an example of this? Other than Moses. So the Medrash says, what do you mean? V'chem B'Yoshua, Joshua. It says, Shal Na'alecha. Joshua was told, take your shoes off. And furthermore, V'chein HaKoyanim, the Kohanim, Lo Shimshu, they did not serve B'Migdash in the temple, Ela Yechefim. They had to be barefoot. So we see two other examples, which together with Moshe makes three, and that's a number in which something gets established, that there's this notion that if you're standing in a place of divine revelation, take your shoes off. So the Rebbe says, Yesh Leimer B'tam HaDavar. Perhaps this can be an explanation as to why we should take our shoes off. Mashmo Uson Shel Na'alayim, the meaning or intimation of shoes, Hu Yetziras Chatzitza, is the creation of a separation, a hefsek, Bein HaAdam U'Bein HaAdamah, between the person and between the ground. Now the ground represents artsius, represents earthiness. The ground represents chumrius, represents materialism. The Rebbe notes the following. Reisha shel Adam, a person's head, hu mitivei gavaya umuvdo min haaretz. The part of a person that's furthest from the ground, assuming one has an upright posture, is the head. Shekein, ha'evodim va'akeches ha'nailim sheba Adam, the loftier a person's faculties get, he mitivam nailim urecheke michumris. They become naturally further from the materialistic reality of things. That's the way it is. Not with an animal. An animal walks on all four. So the animal's heart is right above the ground, and his head is no better off. But a human being, whose posture is erect, is upright, so the head is the furthest from the ground. Avel achelik ha'tachten sheba adam, the lowest part of the person, haregel, the foot, who mitivei is, if one is in a natural state, not an acrobat walking on his hands, mitivei karov la'aretz, the feet are naturally closest to the ground. V'noita l'inyonim artsiyim v'chumrim, it is the feet that are almost naturally in step with the material reality. There's an interesting expression in Avestad Abnasan, a famous expression, at the end of the 31st chapter, that says that the Ekev Cheberegel, that the heel of the feet, is called Malach HaMavas Cheberadam. It's called the angel of death of the person. It just means the part of the person that has the least amount of vitality, least amount of life. So why do you have to take your shoes off? Well, the thing is this. In order to create a distinction, a separation between a chelik ha'tachten shabadah, between the lowest part of the person, ubein ha'aretz, and between the actual ground, you have to wear shoes. That's why we have a need for shoes. The shoes literally protect us, and the shoes create a distinction, a barrier between us and the ground upon which we walk. Kedei shegam chelik zeh shabadah le'yishka legamri b'teich ha'artzias, so that this part of the person does not literally become harmed or filthy, but it doesn't become totally sunken into the materialistic realm. So you don't have to wear shoes on your head, because even without wearing shoes on your head is still not getting dirty from the mud on the ground, at least not in a normal situation. You don't have to wear special covers on your knees unless you're planning to kneel, and you don't have to wear something on your body so that you don't hit the ground. You're not planning to be on the ground. But the one part of your body that you need to have a thick vestment, a thick form of attire, is the feet. Because otherwise the feet will be on the ground. And whatever's going to be on the ground is going to be on you, whether it's filth or whether it's sharp things, or whether you're talking about this in a more metaphysical way, a spiritual way, the idea of artsius, the idea of greater emphasis on materialism. So when do we need shoes? We need shoes when we're on ground, which is harmful. Kol zeh kishemadubur makam shel chulma. We speak about, let's talk on the spiritual level, a place which is mundane. Aval kashemadubur ba'ad mas kodesh. When you're speaking about sacred soil, if you want, in the metaphor, we could say soft soil, nice grass. There's no reason to create a barrier between the person and between the ground. The person should not go barefoot in this place. Why? You want to minimize the separation.
Should go barefoot.
Should go barefoot, pardon me. You want to create a connection. There shouldn't be a separation between Ubein HaKodesh. And that's what Moshe Rabbeinu is told, it's holy ground. Plug in, get your shoes off. Yeshua is told, take your shoes off. Kohanim, the Beis HaMikdash, in order for them to be able to accomplish what was necessary, they were told, take your shoes off.
So there's nowhere today holy enough, even maybe at the Kotel, where you don't go with shoes.
There's nowhere holy enough that we say, don't go with shoes. Right. There's no Admas Kodesh per se, although it is customary that when you go to the oil, or other resting sites at Tzaddikim that we take our shoes off. So, there is a place.
When we say we take our shoes off, but we still go in with a separate